The Tom Woods Show, episode 1500.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you've ever considered publishing a book through Kindle, I have a lot of experience with it. I helped to publish Bob Murphy's book in Kindle, my own book, Real Descent, that was self-published, I published in Kindle, and I've assembled some videos that will show you step-by-step all the tech aspects of preparing your manuscript to be published as a Kindle book, and also a series of strategies that most people don't know about that Kindle itself makes available to you to help get the word out about your book so people actually see it and buy it. Get these videos for free at tomwoods.com/Kindle. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here talking about the U.S. presidency today with Jeremy Bailey, who's a professor of political science at the University of Houston and the author of the brand new book, The Idea of Presidential Representation, an Intellectual and Political History. Professor Bailey, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
I find this a very interesting topic, and I guess I want to start this way. My understanding of the key turning point on the question of presidential representation was that it came fairly early on with the way Andrew Jackson looked at the presidency, because he looked at himself in a way that I think was different from how his predecessors looked at themselves as presidents, in that he thought of himself as being the representative of the American people because, in effect, the whole country votes for the president, but the whole country does not vote for individual senators and representatives. And at the time, this alarmed John C. Calhoun, who thought, the problem with this is there is no single undifferentiated American people. We have the people of Virginia. We have the people of Massachusetts. We don't have an American people. And so Jackson is making a dangerous power grab here by purporting to be something that there is no constitutional place for. Now, is there anything wrong in what I just said?
No, that basically captures a good bit of what happened. Your description of Jackson is right on. I wouldn't say that Jackson is the first. I would say that Jefferson is actually a little bit fairly close to Jackson's position. It's not as clear as Jackson's, but Jefferson's obviously earlier. Calhoun's opposition is also about how you characterize it. And I would add to that it's not just Calhoun that objects. It's the really the whole Whig opposition to Jackson. So it's not just a Calhoun thing. Rather, it's an anti-Jackson thing. And the Whig critique of the presidency is really predicated on a rejection of this notion of a president who represents the people. We could say more about that, but.
Yeah, we'll have to. And yeah, the thing is, yeah. You'll have to try and keep me on point here because mm-hmm. I'm going to want to drift off into related questions that are not quite on target. Like, for example, the imperial presidency is not quite the same thing. But nevertheless, I think it has ideological roots in the same sort of place. And so you would later on in the 20th century, you would find critics of a strong executive who would lament the rise of the imperial presidency. But then, when their party's in power, suddenly those criticisms are muted. Do you find that in your study of American history that you can nevertheless pinpoint some parties or groups or individuals who were pretty consistent in their view of the presidency, and it didn't just matter who was occupying it?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. And the short answer is it's really hard. And for about 20 years now, I've been publishing on the question of executive power in American political history and American political thought. And a lot of the criticism that I get from, say, my more empirical, quantitative, positivist, if you will, colleagues is that this is simply partisan posturing. It doesn't mean anything. Whether or not you like executive power depends on who has the White House. And there's obviously a good bit of truth to that. Now, my response to that is really two things. Number one is that even if that's the case, the low road or the partisan arguments can tell you something about how the institutions are working. In other words, which kinds of arguments are people using versus which kinds of arguments are they not using? And so even if you assume that they're partisan simply, they can still identify a lot about how people are thinking about the office. Secondly, there are other kinds of politicians, political actors who have different kinds of ambitions, maybe because they want to be in the White House, maybe because they want to be on the Supreme Court, maybe because they want to affect a greater body of thought, who by their own self-understanding aspire to a larger than usual kind of consistency on these kinds of questions. And when you start to follow them, you can find something theoretically interesting that's going on.
The way you situate your book, The Idea of Presidential Representation, it's situated in the way any good scholarly book would be, and that is to lay out the way people have customarily thought about some issue and then try to bring some nuance to that question. So what is indeed the way people have thought about this, and what clarification are you trying to bring?
Okay, yeah. So I think for your listeners, there are maybe two ways I'd say this. Number one, among conservative academics for a couple of decades, there has been a common narrative that the progressives changed America by changing the Constitution at the beginning of the 20th century. And one crucial part of that change, not the entirety of that change, but one crucial part of that change was changing the presidency. And by creating a modern presidency, they changed the American constitutional order. So I'm challenging that narrative by arguing, A, that the progressives were not the first, and B, conservatives should like this part, they weren't victorious. There was actually considerable pushback on that theory. And so I'm really the first person to ask, you know, did that critique achieve what it intended? And my answer to that is no. The other way to think about it is, look, people argue about executive power all the time, but they base their arguments on different foundations, if you will. And one foundation is law, in my opinion. The other foundation is public opinion. And what we see in the course of our history is the two parties, the party of Jackson, if you will, appeal to public opinion, while the other party appeals to the formal law as the source of executive power.
I want to raise what would perhaps be viewed as a crude way of measuring the growth in executive power, and that has to do with executive orders. Now, since the year, I don't know, maybe since Bill Clinton, ever since we heard stroke of the pen, law of the land, kind of cool, you've seen conservatives get concerned about this. And then under George W. Bush, people were concerned about his so-called signing statements, where he had signed a bill, but then in so signing, he would indicate that he had no intention of being bound by provision, you know, A12 or whatever it was. And that was likewise considered a problem. Now, there's nothing per se constitutionally dubious about an executive order. There are plenty of things a president can do by executive order. For example, issuing a pardon can be done by executive order. That's no constitutional problem. But what arose was a concern that executive orders were sometimes being abused as a way of avoiding the need to consult Congress. And so when I look at, I mean, for example, Abraham Lincoln issued a whole bunch of them, but the Civil War was going on, so that's not illustrative. But when I look at after Abraham Lincoln, I go through the late 19th century and then up through Teddy Roosevelt, I see basically most of these people issue a handful of them. I think Cleveland in his second term may have issued somewhere around 70. But then you get to Teddy Roosevelt, and he issues over 1,000. So it does seem to me that just by that crude metric, even if everybody didn't imbibe his philosophy of the presidency, something real did happen there.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me say something about executive orders. A colleague of mine, Brandon Rottinghouse, we spent a couple of years thinking about executive orders and also proclamations, in particular policy proclamations. Most people think proclamations are simply ceremonial. It's not true. They're often policy related. And it turns out for most of the 19th century, what we think of executive orders were actually issued as proclamations. Executive orders weren't codified until 1936, and so they don't take a very good form until 1936 or so, maybe 1935. And that's why you see most of political science studies of executive orders are basically from FDR or Truman forward. You do see some websites that'll try their best to codify executive orders before then, but it's a little messy.
Okay.
Now, to get to your point, it's absolutely true. And if you just take policy proclamations, there's a huge spike in the progressive era. And so you see that spike among the progressive presidents, that's Wilson and TR. But you also see that spike, it's not as high as them, but also Taft, Coolidge, Harding, and Hoover also are issuing proclamations at a far greater rate than their predecessors in the 19th century. And the answer for that basically is the expansion of the national government and the delegation of power from Congress to the president. And we can talk more about that. But that to me is the main issue. When people think about executive orders today from the perspective of the Constitution, the simplest way to understand them is that most of them have either a clear delegation or a somewhat shady delegation from Congress. And then the real question is, will Congress fix it if they don't think the power has actually been delegated?
Right. Okay. But there is no, you may say this one's an outlier, but there's one example from TR's presidency that always stuck with me, and it's fairly obscure, but he's trying to reach trying to come up with a treaty with the Dominican Republic, and the Senate goes into recess without voting on it, mm-hmm. and he's tired of this do-nothing Senate, so he decides he's just going to go ahead and implement the treaty, but simply not call it a treaty. He'll call it an executive agreement.
Yeah.
And then he says in his memoir, he celebrates this expressly as his philosophy of the presidency, that if you're not going to do anything, then the person who is going to do something is going to be the one who exercises the power. I mean, he's very, very open about this.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely true. He says the same thing about some of his proclamations with respect to federal lands that were clearly beyond Congress's intent in the 1906 Antiquities Act. And he gloats about him going beyond Congress's will because he sees Congress's will as being too closely connected to special interest, and that is logging. And so, yeah, you see, absolutely, TR is totally glories in this. But what is interesting, in my opinion, is that TR's justification went further, well beyond anyone before him, and maybe even arguably anyone after him. From my perspective, what's interesting about that is that this actually wasn't necessarily accepted by those around him. Or to put it differently, people like Elihu Root, other people in his inner circle, they were mystified by TR's claims. They thought they went too far. They thought that TR is transforming the Constitution. And this, as one of them put it, turned Taft from a man into a principal. And so the move to Taft was not just a move, as sometimes is often put, to protect business interests, but also because people were concerned about TR's, what they saw as an attempt to transform the Constitution.
All right, let's pause just a minute and come right back. All right, everybody, for just a moment, I want you all to gather around, listen to what I have to say here. Old Woods has something very important to tell you. And I know you're going to say, Woods, I've heard you promote Skillshare before. I already know what Skillshare is all about, but I'm not sure you really do if you haven't joined it yet and gotten your 2 free months. The over 24,000 classes at Skillshare teach you all kinds of things that you might want to learn just because you're curious, but also plenty of things that will give you a leg up in your career. Design, illustration, entrepreneurship, photo and film, technology, business. And for example, if I click on technology, I find courses on search engine optimization, 3D printing, how to design a mobile app, all kinds of skills that you can acquire from the comfort of your own home. If you listen to the Tom Woods Show, you're a lifelong learner, and you're going to be like a kid in a candy store with Skillshare. Well, you can join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. Skillshare is offering Tom Woods Show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 24,000 classes for free. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/woodsfree. Again, go to Skillshare.com/woodsfree to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/woodsfree. I want to talk about the difference between TR and Wilson on this, but there's something I'm just kind of dying to ask you. How does this all relate to the idea that we just take for granted today that the president is going to come into office with a legislative agenda, and we vote for the president expecting that agenda to be implemented? It seems to me that early on in the history of the Republic, this would have been viewed as a kind of, well, intimidation of the Congress, that really Congress is supposed to be where these legislative initiatives spring from, and for the president to come in and demand that they more or less follow his lead seems to be an inversion of at least the spirit of Article II.
Yeah, I think that's true. Now, to be fair, you could see there's a reading of the Federalist Papers when you get into Federalist 71, 72, where Hamilton is starting to talk about the president as someone with something like an agenda, at least of somebody that's going to have like a plan, that the president's going to be using his power to go on offense, not simply to protect the office against, you know, incursions by Congress. I'm thinking of his phrase, he must be able to dare to act his own ambition. And so you can make a case, and people have made the case, that there's a more muscular presidency with somebody with a vision in mind that some part of the constitutional framework expected. Now, pushing that to the side, it's absolutely the case that we expect that today. going all the way back to the 1840s, when, you know, the political parties start to have platforms which commit them to a set of programmatic principles, we have seen one party argue, look, elections mean something. And that was the Jacksonian Party. The truth is that for a lot of the 19th century, and you see this in Lincoln's presidency especially, the Republican Party wasn't entirely comfortable with this idea. And they especially weren't comfortable with the idea that the election endorsed some sort of presidential action. What they believed is endorsed, it is endorsed a particular set of office holders who would meet in Congress and deliberate about the good of the nation as a whole. And that was the Whig understanding of what an election did. The Jacksonians argued, look, an election, like for example, the election of 1832, settled the question of the bank. That's how Jackson characterized it. The Whigs respond, say, this is totally crazy. And Lincoln gives a very interesting speech on the presidential question, he calls it, in the late 1840s, in which he totally eviscerates the idea that a presidential election can settle a policy issue. And so if you go back and you watch Lincoln's movements in, you know, as president, he's on the one hand justifying executive power, but he's not doing so on the basis of a popular mandate.
Now, let's go back, if we may, then to Woodrow Wilson, because I'd like to get your first. I'd like to get a sense of what his view of the presidency was. He did write this book, Congressional Government, early on. So I'd like to know what the thesis of that was. And then again, what he wound up doing with the presidency and what critics may have said about him at the time.
OK, so let me give you the standard view. The standard view, this is again, that Wilson is sort of a kind of a It's both a standard view among academics who study American political thought and also the standard view among conservatives. And that is that the progressives change the Constitution by changing the presidency, and T.R. and Wilson constitute a kind of 1-2 punch in that transformation. And the thing about Wilson for me, and this, I'm not the first person to say this by any means, but I think I draw it a little bit further, is that Wilson is way more interested in maintaining some sort of semblance of constitutional propriety than TR is. And that's in particular because Wilson cares about federalism and states' rights in a way that TR has no patience for. And you can see that in their various philosophical influences. Herbert Croly is the great advisor, the great intellectual influence on TR. Louis Brandeis is the great influence on Wilson. And Croly, in particular, thinks one of the great flaws of the American Constitution is that it's too local. There's too much authority given to the states, and the political elected politicians are too local in their views because they're connected to local electoral constituencies in actual districts. And so Croly wants to upend all of that. And so the key difference between TR and Wilson is that Wilson actually has a place in his heart for something that we might call limited government. Now, there's all sorts of ways in which he violates the principles of limited government. I'm sure you're aware of all of them. But in his rhetoric, at least, he carves out a space for limited government in a way that TR never would. If you go back and you read Wilson's first inaugural, you'll see all the places that he calls for restraint, that utter transformation is not his goal, that they have an inherited framework, and that inherited framework is one of limited government, and that's largely a good thing.
Well, let me say this. If we posit that the progressives did not, whatever their intentions may have been, did not succeed in implementing the scope of the types of changes that their modern-day critics think they did, then the question becomes, at some point, we do get a presidency of the kind we have today where we have the spectacle of like a year and a half of electioneering going on and vast promises being made on all sides. Yeah. And the things that wouldn't have, like, for example, if I may draw an example from the progressive era, when TR summoned people to the White House because several people had died because college football was so brutal in those days. So he convened a little mini conference about it. And that would have struck Jefferson as a very strange incursion into the normal activities of civil society. I mean, surely as a society, we can probably handle the violence in college football problem. It would have seemed strange, like almost a trespassing into civil society by the president. So that's already happening under the progressives. And today, we all expect that we're going to know that today the president is playing golf and we're going to know what his handicap is. And there's almost a messianic character to the presidency. Yeah. That must have come from somewhere.
Okay, so my take on this is that probably the most important thing that happened was the McGovern-Fraser reforms of 1971, when the Democratic Party took control of the nomination process away from party elites and from professional politicians and gave it to amateur voters, political actors who are basically, you know, ideologically pure suburbanites. And what that did is it totally democratized the selection process, and it changed the kind of presidents that we get. We get outsiders who make grandiose claims about transformation based on experience they don't have. Their experience is always outside the Beltway, so they don't run on their credibility inside of Washington. They run on their credibility outside of Washington. That's all McGovern-Fraser. And one of the things that I discovered in this book that surprised me is that the framers of the McGovern-Fraser didn't know they were creating that. Specifically, they did not expect that the result of their rule changes would lead to the vast majority of nominating procedures in the states being primaries. They thought there'd be just as many caucuses, and caucuses would have different consequences. And when you look at people like Austin Rainey, who is a political scientist at the Arizona Convention, and that some of the lectures he gives in the 1970s, he's like, look, we let the cat out of the bag, and we had no idea it was coming. And this is why they tried to change it in the 80s with the superdelegates. But the truth is there was maybe a cadre of people who did know it, and it was the staff, professional staff, who were working for the actual members of the McGovern-Fraser Commission. And these were McGovern insiders from the 1968 race who had, you know, a plan for changing the way Democrats elected their officials. So I think that's one important step. The other way I'd answer your question is I would say, look at conservatism and the presidency that emerges in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, and particularly the arguments about the unitary executive. And what you see when you look very close is that the vast majority of arguments about the unitary executive are made explicitly in a way that rejects public opinion as a source of authority.
Well, can you back up and just define for everybody the term unitary executive?
Yeah, unitary executive means that Article 2 reads, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States, as opposed to Article 1, which says all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. So there are two differences. Article 1 speaks of legislative powers, plural. Article 2 speaks of a single executive power. And then Article 1 has herein granted, Article 2 does not. And going back to 1789, Americans have argued that the difference between the two clauses means that there's something called the executive power, and the president has all of it. And so you actually read, and Scalia writes this in a famous dissent, that you read the vesting clause of Article 2 to mean all executive power shall be vested in the president of the United States. Now, in 1986, conservative legal theory arrived at something called the unitary executive, capital U, capital E. And they used it on the one hand, in the Iran-Contra minority opinion, which was supervised by Dick Cheney. And then on the other example is the independent prosecutor case, in which Scalia uses the phrase unitary executive for the first time in Supreme Court history. And if you look at the two versions of the argument, one is based on presidential representation, that is a kind of normative accountability to the American people. And the other version is a formal reliance on Article 2, and a rejection of the public opinion part. And if you watch how that debate inside conservative circles goes, you see that more and more during the Bush administration, particularly in the academic writings of John Yoo, that in the legal opinions, but given by John Yoo as head of the Office of Legal, or at least in the Office of Legal Counsel, that there's a reliance on the Article 2 part, and that is the law part, not a reliance on public opinion. And that has entirely to do with, I think, by a consistent strategy by Dick Cheney. And so my take on this is that even though we have something like an imperial president, the way that people talk about the imperial president, the way that people defend the imperial president differs. And the way it differs actually matters a great deal about our constitutional order.
All right. So let's wrap up here. You've done an enormous amount of reading, primary and secondary, on this subject. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you probably know more about the American presidency than just about anybody in the U.S. at this point. So why should Americans understand this? Why does this matter? I mean, sometimes scholars write things that only other scholars can even understand the significance of, but I don't think that's the case here. So what would you say is your, not that history has to have a message per se, but what do you want to convey to the American public so they'll understand their own system better?
Two things. We're taught that the founders gave us a presidency who, by way of the Electoral College, was not supposed to be elected by normal voters. That is, the Electoral College was an elite institution meant to constrain democracy. I believe that's false. That's not the explanation behind the Electoral College. Second thing, we're taught that the American presidency changed in the 20th century. Some people think this is a good change. Some people think it was a bad change. And that part of that change was the greater representative nature of the presidency. I argue the representative nature of the presidency has been contested since the very beginning, since the debates over the Electoral College. We Americans have been arguing about it. And there has not been a transformation, but rather we continue to argue about it. And the way we argue about the presidency actually matters for the importance of the presidency in our constitutional structure.
I guess because I'm so old-fashioned when I look at this stuff, I find it impossible to imagine that a president who simply says, my sole intention is to humbly execute the laws, would have any chance whatsoever, right? That's not at all what we're looking for. We want somebody who's going to have a robust agenda, who's going to change institutions, who's going to do this and that. But yet I do think in the past, I mean, I don't think I'm imagining it. I do think there was at least some sense that I mean, there's a reason that you can't even remember the names of most of the 19th century presidents. And It's not just because you didn't pay attention in school.
Yeah, that has to do with the nominating rules. Different kinds of people are running for president because it took a different skill set to become a nominee. And being moderately safe was good from the perspective of political party bosses. But anyway, I digress. You're absolutely right. There is a change in our culture. What I would say is that there still is hope. If you want the Constitution to have some sticking power, there is some reason for hope. And that reason for hope is that the argument for presidential representation is not completely legitimate yet. And that is that the opposition party has never conceded, or the opposition party, especially the Republican Party. The Republican Party is still the party that's most reluctant to accept the idea. And that is that the opposition party in Congress is still likely going to say, hey, wait a minute, there is something that represents the people, and it's called Congress. It's not the president.
Okay, that's very, very interesting point. We'll close on that. I am going to link people to your faculty page at the University of Houston, but do you have a website or anything else you'd like us to link to other than, of course, your book, which is the Idea of Presidential Representation, an Intellectual and Political History?
The faculty page is fine. You can also find me on academia.edu or even Amazon. My other books are up there too. I've got a page on Amazon, so whatever.
Okay. All right. So we'll put all these up.
Yeah.
These will be at the show notes page, this being episode 1500, tomwoods.com/1500. Well, thank you for your time. And I talked about a lot of popular books published by trade publishers. So it's nice to talk to an academic about an academic book from time to time. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for doing it. That's great.
All right, folks, before we wrap up for today, I want to remind you that next week on the program, so a few episodes from now, begins Dave Smith Week on the show. We all know Dave, great libertarian hero, and I am soliciting some ideas for that. I've already recorded a few of the episodes for that, but I've solicited some ideas from the Supporting Listeners Group. And if you're not part of that Supporting Listeners Group, doggone it, why not? If you like this show, you would absolutely love being part of that. You get many, many neat benefits available nowhere else, but also you get membership in the Tom Woods Show Elite. And man, are you going to be glad you took me up on that. So supportinglisteners.com is the website for that, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.